Hello, dear LTS listeners. Shelly back here again with, sadly, a second little disclosure about the nature of today's recording. I said last time that I had a little static on my track and that that problem was solved. Well, I should have checked the last recording I had in the can before I bought a new piece of gear. And there is a little bit of static on my track for this recording about silk stockings. Hopefully it won't annoy you too much. Hopefully silk stockings won't annoy you too much. But we recorded the next edition of the show last night on the new equipment, and it sounds great! Apologies and enjoy. It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley, your host, and this is episode 51, Silk Stockings. Ladies and gentlemen, today we're talking about a late 50s musical from MGM, house of late 50s musicals, in glorious Technicolor, breathtaking CinemaScope, and or stereophonic sound. But I can't do that alone. I need two panelists to join me to help out. And welcome back to the show, Phil Michaels. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you very much. I will not be attempting a Russian accent because I've learned my lesson from all the actors in Silk Stockings.
Much appreciated. And also, I always want to blame somebody when we pick a film, and I can't really completely blame David J. Lohr, but I can sort of blame him because I think it was my idea and he encouraged me. So hi, David. Welcome.
There's absolutely no truth to the rumors. We're just good friends.
That's the best one.
That is a runner, is what we call that.
That is indeed.
Yep.
Indeed. Well, briefly, Silk Stockings from 1957, directed by Ruben Mamoulian and starring Fred Astaire, Sid Charisse, Janice Page, Peter Lorre, Jules Munchen. I'm not even looking at my notes for all of these character actors making with Russian accents. There's just a lot of them. George Tobias, who's fun. Anyways, lots of people, but it's basically Fred and Sid dancing and Janice Page being fun. And we'll talk all about it. It's a musical. Did I mention that? Perhaps I didn't. But I would now like to offer David J. Lohr an opportunity to make an opening statement before we proceed with the discussion of this Cole Porter musical of the late Porter period. David, take it away.
And as listeners of other Incomparable shows know, I am not one for making opening statements. But you know, Cole Porter is my guy. I love Cole Porter. When it comes to Broadway composers, there's Cole Porter, and there's a whole bunch of others who are almost as good, right? It's a little hyperbolic. You know, I love Sondheim, I love Lin-Manuel. Yes, fine. But Porter was always my guy. I have all the albums. I've got the complete lyrics book. If you love good lyrics, get it. It's wonderful. This was the last show he wrote for the stage before it was adapted to a film. And, Porter, for me, is the lyrics, right? The lyrics are great. His melodies are wonderful, but it's the lyrics that make him, the wit, the cleverness. And this is one of the few times where I will tell you, if you watch this Cole Porter musical, don't listen to the lyrics. Just enjoy the melodies, enjoy the dancing, fast forward through everything else. It's...
Cole Porter, I saw your last musical, and it should have been your last musical.
last musical really should have been his last musical.
An opening that statement that ends with a sigh. That's what we want.
If I can jump on David's
Feel
statement
free.
Here. I would agree with that, with the exception of say Siberia, which I think is
yes.
A pretty good comedy tune. This is not his finest work, and in fact it has the feel of the rock and roll album that Mel Torme tried to do in the 1970s to connect with the kids, because you got Cole Porter trying to do rock songs and being all
very
uncomfortable. I'm still hip. No, do what you're good at.
The smart set took it on.
Yeah. I recently took my daughter to the movies, because they were doing a special screening of the 2021 staging of Anything Goes with Sutton
yes.
Foster from the West End.
Mm-hmm.
And actually that will be on PBS in May, I believe, if you keep an eye peeled for that. I think it's coming to Great Performances at some point. That is good Cole Porter. That is great Cole Porter. This is Cole Porter playing this, out this the string, emptying out the song bag.
This is Cole in between Les Girls with Gene Kelly, which is excruciating.
Yes, I agree.
And the TV musical Aladdin, which is excruciating. This at least, I mean, there are clever bits and bobs in the middle of songs, and then it is somehow more retrograde sexist than Ninotchka, which was 20 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
How?
So many things to say. The rock and roll thing, that just makes me uncomfortable. And whenever there's like a little, first of all, the Fred Astaire and rock and roll of it all is terrible. But when there's a hint of a guitar in the background, it's like, oh, I don't want to listen mm-hmm. to the rest of the song. I have to stop right now. That's mm-hmm. just terrible. What gives me more conflict, though, are songs that I enjoy from a musical and performance. I love Janis Paige in this movie. I really do.
She's great.
There are yeah. lots of problems with the lyrics of the songs she's singing, but dang, I like watching her. And I think David's right. I think it's the music. There is clever wordplay of the Porter variety in some of those songs, but you're also right that it's kind of pieces of those songs. Like, oh, that's a clever turn of phrase and right. a clever turn of leg, if you will, and a clever piece of music. But Janis Paige is just adorable to watch. And I think she's my favorite thing in this movie.
Oh, yeah. By a wide mile.
I would counter that. I would say, and this sort of, again, goes back to what David said. David, who's the template of everything to be said about Silk Stockings. The numbers where it's just Sid Charisse and Fred Astaire dancing and there's no singing going on. Because that's not Sid Charisse singing, and Fred Astaire can't sing. So when it's just them dancing, those are wonderful numbers. Those are wonderful bits. Imagine the Central Park scene from The Bandwagon, but you get a couple yes. of different numbers like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. And then someone starts singing, and you're all oh.
Well, it's like there's one late in the film. Fated to be mated, which we were spotted to be knotted. Stop. And then as soon as they stop singing and it becomes a medley of other better melodies, again, without words, it's a lovely number. But yeah, up until they shut up, just, oh. And it's interesting because this was Astaire's retirement from musical films. When he crushes his top hat at the end, that was supposed to be a symbolic thing, you know, this is it. And the numbers in this are much more reminiscent of the TV specials he was doing later, Astaire Time, An Evening with Fred Astaire, which are just him and usually Sid Charisse dancing to songs out of context of any kind of plot, any kind of romance. It's just, here are two dancers who dance really well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's... This feels like those.
I think one of the reasons we had a conversation some time ago about icky movies where Fred Astaire is dancing with a much younger woman. In other
yeah.
words, most of them. But I've always felt less icky about this because Sid Charisse is so much fun to watch. And as a dancer, when they're just dancing, it's not old man and young girl. It's not like he's dancing with Audrey Hepburn and it's like, ew, this is creepy.
Right, that's excruciating,
yes,
too.
Yes, and Sid Charisse is a confident, very physical, very tall dancer, and she works with, and Astaire was smart about partners, and he realized that if she was going to be willing to dance with him, he should probably hang on to that. Not that he was a slouch as a dancer at that point in his life. It's just that they look well together. I think also the reason I don't find it particularly creepy is I sort of don't believe them as a couple ever, in either before they get together or even at the end.
No.
Although I think she has a couple of nice moments, which I'll get to when I talk about scenes. But I don't feel threatened. I don't feel like he's going to, you know, compromise her virtue or whatever because she's this sweet young thing and he's this creepy old dude, he is a creepy old dude.
I had the exact opposite reaction. I agree that when they're dancing, it's fine. They're dancing. Dancing is the highest form of human expression. But when he immediately walks in and sees Sid Charisse there and just starts hitting on her right away. There is no buildup. Yeah. There is no.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Absolutely.
There is no meet cute, and it is granddad. Put it away, please.
Well, and when it's plot, when it's dialogue, it is horrible watching the two of them.
Is.
And it literally, as soon as they shut up, it's just sparkling dancers.
It is
that scene in the bandwagon.
The writing is not very good, and she's not great. And she's acting a difficult part, but I also just don't think she's that good at it.
No,
she can be a good actress, but she's really not very good in this as an actor.
No. And also, I believe they were 28 years apart in age when this was made.
It's 22, roughly.
Okay. I've added 6 years in there. Okay.
22,
still,
28.
Still,
mid 30s, late 50s.
That's the father daughter dance at a wedding that they're doing. Instead, we're supposed to go, oh, yeah, this is very romantic.
Now, I will say, I have a pair of friends who are that span.
Well,
and they're quite happy, but they don't dance.
Good for them.
They have good dialogue.
See, for years and years, my first exposure to Fred Astaire was from the old man dances with much younger women period of his career, whether it was this or Daddy Long Legs or
Leslie Caron or Audrey Hepburn,
Funny
Face, who all read much younger. And Sid Charisse, again, she is quite a lot younger, but she's in her 30s.
Yeah,
she's a grown woman. And so for me, like, the creep factor when I'm watching them on screen, again, it's because I don't take them seriously. It has a lot to do with it.
So I was, but I was always, Fred Astaire, he's not so great. And then then you see the Ginger Rogers and the Rita Hayworth stuff, and you're all, okay, he was actually all right when he was dancing with someone more age appropriate.
Yeah, even Rita Hayworth, for me, considerably younger than him, but not quite as much as this.
and not noticeably in the same way, I mean, I love the Fred and Ginger films. Don't get me wrong, they are, you know, some of my happiest old film times. You know, I love Shall We Dance. I love Swing Time. Swing Time is underrated. And, you know, and when he's dancing with Eleanor Powell in Broadway Melody of 1940, is it 40 or 41? I think it's 40.
It's that,
Not a film I love. Also a Cole Porter film. Mm-hmm. But again, when the two of them are dancing together, she might be the best partner he ever had, or at least the most accomplished. But, you know, for me, Sid Charisse might be right up there in second place. And then Ginger and Rita. And then all the other people,
I would watch, and Sid, I feel like I would watch her, whoever she was dancing with.
Yeah.
Because she's just so accomplished and so self-possessed. And, you know, I don't remember she did anything with Gene Kelly, who's the dancer that I like to watch a lot because he's just so athletic. And I don't know. I just feel like the two of them would eat the screen alive. But
she's in the Gotta Dance number in Singing in the Rain.
That's her.
That's Sid Charisse in the green dress.
Right. Oh.
And the legs. True. The legs that go all the way up. God, I love Sid Charisse's legs.
We gotta do Singing in the Rain at some point. There's like popular groundswell for that one, too.
Speaking of her legs, it is the most insipid lyric in the movie, the Red Blues.
Yeah.
But the dance number. I love the dance number. And it is such a simple, basic dress. There is nothing special about that dress. And yet the way it moves and flows.
Absolutely. She flares it out beautifully. I like the scene. I agree with you. The song is dumb, but I love the scene where they start it. It's interrupted. That was what I was going to say about favorite scene. I really like the sequence where they're back in Russia together, she and the commissars, mm-hmm. because you can see the friendship between them. And I think it's her best acting in the movie because she's sad, not only for having lost Fred Astaire, whatever, but she's sad because she's, you know, with these guys who've also shared this same experience with her, and they feel like a little family. And then they do this number, where the song is terrible, but then you've got the people walking through and they stop the number and they start again. And it just feels like an earned, happy respite for these people. And it's just, it's a lovely moment.
It's one of the few truly comic, well-paced, well-blocked scenes in the movie. It's a really odd movie.
It really is.
The pacing is off. The, you know, there's song, long stretch of dialogue. Song.
I can't prove it, but when I was watching it recently for this purpose, there were a couple scenes that I didn't really remember. And it's entirely possible that there are cut versions out there that are fairly commonly shown, because I remember thinking there were a couple of scenes that were just interminable and I didn't remember them. Like the whole bit where the commissar has been replaced and the new commissar sends for Yashchenko and is going to send her off. This whole long bit where he's got a mistress and he's got a wife and he's the new commissar, and it just goes on forever. And I'm just like, wait, could we just skip to the musical numbers or even leave Russia? Because why is this scene so long?
That's Mr. Kravitz from Bewitched,
yes,
isn't it?
That's George Tobias, right.
Yeah, that's why you keep that in. That's gold, baby.
Well, I'll agree with that. He's in a lot of movies, though, George Tobias.
Yes.
he was in Ninotchka.
Oh, I didn't clock that. That's great, though. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. There you go. Continuity, ladies and gentlemen. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
The Ninotchka cinematic universe is alive and well.
So is that the title, or is Put It Away Grandpa the title? Who knows?
Oh, we'll have a few, I'm sure.
I'm sure. This is the time of year when we remind you about how you can support this podcast by becoming a member of The Incomparable. You can sign up for a monthly or annual pledge to support this podcast directly. Here's what you do. Go to theincomparable.com/members and sign up. You can choose which podcasts on the network you'd like to support and just check the box for Lions, Towers, and Shields. Your contribution will come directly to us after a few fees are taken out. If you listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, which you probably should because they're, you know, pretty decent, you can check those boxes too, and your contribution will be divided equally among all the shows you want to support. As a thank you for supporting us, members receive lots of extras, including several podcast feeds for members only, including an ad-free version of The Incomparable Mothership, bootlegs of live recordings, and a special feed full of bonus episodes that only members get to hear. New members will also receive free Incomparable swag as well. Now, May is membership month, and all month long, all of the Incomparable shows are putting out special bonus episodes that members will get to receive. And even if you join now, you get to receive the whole bunch, including the Lions, Towers, and Shields bonus show, in which we review a movie that is not from the 30s through 60s, which is what we usually do here. We talk about What's Up, Doc, a delightful film from 1972 that is an homage of sorts to screwball comedies like Bringing Up Baby, which we did on episode 50. So you can listen to that, and you can listen to all sorts of other shows. And I, your humble host, got dragged into some of those other Incomparable membership shows. So if you just want to hear me not talking about old movies, join, become a member of the Incomparable, and you get to hear all sorts of unexpected, surprising things. There are contribution levels at $5, $10, and $20 per month, and annual subscriptions are available as well. And if you're already a member, it's easy to increase your pledge to a higher level and get some special goodies in return, including some free Incomparable swag, too. If you'd like to support us, go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up. Thanks so much. Can we just talk about Janice Page? We could talk about the problematic lyrics if we want to. But she just brings joy to this whole proceeding. And
she's effervescent.
Like, yeah, she's incredible. She's like an amped up version of Ann Miller in Kiss Me, Kate. She performs the same function.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just love her. And I've seen her in a few other things, but she's not somebody that you're just like, oh, well, here's her 80 films credit. But this is probably her best and best known role. And she's got, what, 3 numbers, which means that they knew that they needed to rely on her to fill a lot of space in this movie.
Uh-huh.
We mentioned the running gag with the "no, we're just good friends" and how that was.
Yeah.
She has the other running bit where she keeps trying to knock the water out of her ear because she's the Esther Williams stand-in with the
right.
So it's one of the few parts where there's actual characterization and playfulness going on. I really enjoy her.
And there, you know, the running gag that the movie that Fred Astaire wants to produce, and it's her first dramatic role without swimming and songs, and it's War and Peace. But then he's the one who says, no, we're just taking a section of War and Peace. Flash forward to a couple of years ago and a show on Broadway, Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812, which is just a portion of War and Peace. It's a really good musical. It's much better than this one.
Good to know.
But I wonder if that's where they got the idea. It's like,
I will also say about Janice Page, just as a bridge to the sexism, if we want to talk about that, that she is very sexualized in this movie, but it is of her own doing. She is not, you know, she's throwing herself all over this guy, and that's the number. And obviously it's for a male audience, but she's made the choice. It's not that Fred Astaire has come in and decided to make her a sexual object like he does Sid Charisse on first meeting her. It's like, not only are you a communist socialist or whatever, but you're hot and I'm going to have you. And Janice Page is just like, look, I'm a movie star. I'm owning this and I'm having fun. And she just gives the impression that whatever she's doing, she's having a great time.
Although it's funny, the first time I saw this, I hadn't realized that it was actually based on a stage show. I thought maybe this was just written for the movie. And there is a lyric in Stereophonic Sound.
Mm-hmm.
If Ava Gardner played Godiva riding on a mare, the people wouldn't pay a cent. They wouldn't even care unless she had glorious Technicolor Cinecolor War. And I, at the time, I got angry because, no, if you're bringing up Lady Godiva, the joke is that they wouldn't pay a cent to see her fully bare. That's mm-hmm. the joke. And it's not.
Wait, why do you have to reach for mayor when you have bear right there?
Well, they wouldn't even care.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
That line just, huh? And yeah, in the original, that's one of the lines they edited. And considering all the ones they didn't, it's like, oh. But yeah, that one was changed.
Yeah. So we have.
And not artfully like the ones in Kiss Me, Kate. Which,
well, and I can argue with some of those.
Far more clever.
They're clever, but there's some that are land weird, and it is funny to go back and listen to both of them. Yeah. We'll
get to that one.
What struck me about you mentioned it was a stage show. I thought, oh, I'll look up who played whom and whether there were any revivals.
Yes.
And Don Ameche, I think, was in the original cast. It does not appear to have been revived at any point.
No.
Ever.
My memory of it was it didn't do very well, but I hadn't looked it up.
It ran for almost 500 performances.
Yeah,
for a year and a half.
Year
All right,
half,
that's
not bad.
Bad.
Yeah.
It was a triumph,
but, worth making
supposedly.
A movie out of.
I mean, it is very much of its time because after there's all the Soviet Union jokes in
Cold
there, and
War
you're
stuff.
All okay. We get it. Yeah, the communism stinks. It's 1957. You are not going to get hauled up before the McCarthy Committee. You're okay. But it never at any point. And there are a lot of musicals that have a dated feel that do get revived. Like How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying is not the most forward-looking musical, but every 20 years or so, someone is doing a production of it. It struck me as really weird that that Silk Stockings never gets the taken out of the freezer and given a lap around the block.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, you
not
could,
for the same reasons, but I mean, The Music Man is up right now, and I would say that's a pretty retro, pretty backwards kind of a musical. And
well, but it was backwards and retro at the time it debuted.
I know, which makes it double awesome. But
yes,
and I mean, some of the things that have been complaints about it, or that they say, oh, they softened it for this one, and you know, Meredith Wilson was writing about Iowa. He did that intentionally, mm-hmm. right? He's not. Just saying, oh, these are, you know, oh, they don't know better. No, he's saying these are retrograde people. And, you know,
yeah.
Strange moment of Glenning. Meredith Wilson wrote the alma mater for Hanover College right here.
Okay, then.
Which I get to sing every once in
Strange
a while.
Strange moment of Glenning. Not going to be the title, despite the fact that Glenn would love it if it were. Because wouldn't that be hilarious if it just showed up in the LTS feed and Glenn was like, wait, what?
Yeah,
no, he'd be like, well, of course. Hello, incomparable members and fans. That's a joke just for you. So let's see. So what? So we have. Let's talk about the various commissars and people faking Russian accents.
Mm-hmm.
Most famously, of course, is Peter Lorre, who I think is fun. I really do.
Peter
Lorre
is
great.
More musicals needed Peter Lorre.
Yes,
I agree.
Although
and you never see him get to do comedy.
And you do. You do get to see him do comedy.
A few times. Because
he made that movie with
so
Vincent
rare.
Price,
that's true. The Pit and the Pendulum.
He does comedy, and he's very good at it.
Beat the Devil.
Yeah. But during some of those musical numbers, I love watching Peter Lorre because he looks like he's frightened. He looks like he is holding on for dear life.
And twice he literally is, where he's hanging and doing the little Russian kick.
The little Russian kick, because can you do a Russian kick, Peter Lorre? No, I cannot. Not without being held up. Please, oh God. And he is just in this Zen-focused phase as he's holding onto the chairs and doing the kicks with the knives between his teeth. And it's just, please, if I just keep doing it, just stop shouting at me.
Well, and it's also
fun
because...
Why are you shouting at me, Ruben? I am doing my best, Ruben.
It's also fun because of the physicality between him and the other two guys who are bigger than he is. And little Peter Lorre.
Oh my God. Jules Munchen is just delightful.
Munchen is so interesting because I always think of him as the third wheel in On the Town.
Right.
And then what else? And I enjoy him.
Now you're limiting him. He's also the third wheel in Take Me Out to the Ball Game, too.
Fair point. So, you know, it's a good gig, and he does it gamely, and he's fun. And I think I appreciate him more now than I did when I first saw it and was so startled that Peter Lorre was in it. I think I watched him more than the other two. But yeah, I enjoy the three of them together. I think they have good timing. I think Munchen is funny. I mean, I think he's good anyway. And I hope he was happy and got good checks for playing all those third wheel roles.
And Joseph Buloff is the third guy, and he often gets overlooked in these discussions. He is probably the funniest of the three. He just has the sort of delivery to all his lines. He's like sort of a
Russian, strange Frank Morgan.
Yeah, thing. I was going to say Russian Frank Morgan.
Frank,
duh, yes.
Or Frank Nelson, that guy.
Frank Nelson, yes.
Oh.
For some reason, I don't know why, but when I was watching it, I was thinking Richard Hayden should be in there somewhere.
Oh yes.
He feels like he should be there.
If you want strange Eastern European accents, Richard Hayden.
I was just thinking like, let's just pick up a bunch of people to make them commissars and just put him in the mix, and like he can wander in and out. But we didn't need him because these guys were great. But they're delightful.
There's a Billy Wilder movie called 1-2-3. Mm-hmm. Which is, I'm telling you guys like you don't know. This is for the audience.
Hi, audience. We're trying to educate you here.
Yeah, Jimmy Cagney is in Cold War Berlin, and he's a Coca-Cola executive. And they have the three East German officials there that he's always dealing with. And I get the same vibe from them as I do from the commissars here. It's just this very... Let's get three funny-looking guys and have them do comedy bits. And I don't know if Billy Wilder was influenced by this or whether it's just such a natural comic trope that, of course, you get three physically dissimilar people and have them do the Stooges routine.
Comedy rule of threes.
Sure. Sure. But I think my favorite thing about this movie, besides the wordless dancing, is anytime the commissars are on screen doing their thing, especially as mentioned, the Siberia number.
The Siberia number
is very good.
The only song that rhymes Siberia with diphtheria.
It's well performed. It's well written. The little flourish with a Siberia is hilarious. Mm-hmm. It's just
that.
It's delightful.
And you know, like. A lot of the songs in this are earworms for me, which I couldn't explain why. But Too Bad and Siberia especially, and maybe it's because they had that effect the first time I saw them, that they were just...
Well, see, Glorious
so
Stereophonic
delightful.
Sound is kind of that way for me, but that's you know.
Well, I mean, almost all of them. Silk Stockings, the title song, which they don't even actually sing.
Right.
That's an earworm.
Is that that's in the overture, right?
It's in the overture, and that's the melody when we have the long Sid Charisse changing clothes montage dance.
That scene can be as long as it wants to, as far as
that's right.
You go, Sid.
Yes,
they'll let you do whatever you need to do. Mm-hmm.
Steals the show.
Yes, indeed.
But yeah, it's silk stockings remind me of you. La da 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 dum. And they never actually sing it, and I don't know why. It's not an offensive lyric, but it's meant for Fred's character in the.
I was gonna say maybe Fred couldn't sing it. I mean not that he could sing anything, but
no.
Yeah, but it's in his range, you know, it's that role. Believe me, go find the Broadway score on Apple Music, and you will find that Don Ameche is no Fred Astaire.
Oh dear.
I've heard him sing in a few movies. Not so much. And
yeah.
Don Ameche in the 50s on Broadway just doesn't seem right. Who was the female lead?
Hildegard Neff.
Of course. Clearly.
The Hildegard Neff?
The Hildegard
Neff.
How did
they get Hildegard
Neff?
I know.
Right? Mm. But George Tobias was Markovitch in the stage version, too. He's the one thing that links all the Ninotchkas.
There's the Ninotchka cinematic
Ninotchkai.
Universe. The Ninotchkai. And George Tobias, he owns all the patents, all the copyrights. He took home all the money, and then he got that job on Bewitched.
The apprenticeship of Abner Kravitz.
I'd see that. I feel like that should be... I don't know. Sorry. I'm not going to go high concept on the apprenticeship. See, another title. I'm not going to go high concept on the apprenticeship of Abner Kravitz, but I suppose I could.
It's totally a piece for The New Yorker.
Sure. And this movie is right kind of at the end of David and I were talking before we started recording about this sort of cycle of big musicals that MGM made in the 50s. And of course, MGM had been making musicals for years and years. But starting in the early 50s, I mean, you have everything from Singing in the Rain, American in Paris, The Bandwagon, Kiss Me, Kate. You're getting down to the end with Silk Stockings here. There's a couple more, but you are getting, and I don't say that to say that it's one of the worst ones. There are plenty of flaws in this movie, but as if you just kind of watch it and don't think too hard and don't let sexism get you down,
yeah,
it can be fun.
And it has its moments.
It does.
It has its moments.
It does. It has charm.
The movie that killed the MGM musical dead was It's Always Sunny Weather.
Yeah.
Or It's Always Fair Weather. Yeah. I forget the...
I think it's Fair Weather.
I was mashing that up with It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which would have made it 10 times more watchable. But that one is the one that I think was the last MGM musical where they said, okay, we've run this genre into the ground and everyone is free to go.
This was probably the last big successful one. So you're trying for a couple of years. I can't remember if Bells Are Ringing is MGM, but there are a couple of other MGM from the late 50s. But this is like the last big one that, you know, did box office and had people that you know and all that.
I think Lee Girls is just before this. And
Gigi,
it is purely written for the screen. And it is just a sour, unpleasant story. The songs are uninspiring. It's about Gene Kelly is a bastard who he has to try and figure out from the three women who used to be part of his act why the act broke up. And basically all of them say, well, because you're a bastard. And that's it. It is an unpleasant musical. And it's like, why was this made? Why did you think this was worth doing? And yeah, they were running out of good Broadway musicals, I guess.
And also the leading men were aging in place.
They were aging out, right?
Yeah.
You didn't have you could potentially plausibly have had some leading women, although I can't think of them, but you're absolutely right because they were relying on, you know, Gene and Fred basically.
Yeah,
if you think
basically.
About it.
And Dan Daly on occasion.
Right, he's in always.
And Howard Keel who picked odd things to do.
He can sing and he can do the leading man bit, but he's not going to dance effectively.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know,
and I
you
mean,
have
there's
your Captain
not a
Graysons
lot of dancing
and people
in Kiss
like that
Kate.
Who, again, are not like, you know.
Well, you have dancing in Kiss Me, Kate. It's just Bob Fosse comes
it's,
in and does it all.
It's Tommy Rawl and Bob Fosse and Bobby Van.
That's what I was
going to
say.
Bobby
like, you pick your leads and then you say, well, what don't the leads have? And then you add in. So, like, Sid and Fred here can dance, but they're not particularly effervescent personalities. So you get Janice Page, who also sexes it up a little bit and is fun. What else, gentlemen? I feel like we're running out of steam on Silk Stockings.
Yeah,
it's
it's very slight. It's the topicality of it, as I as mentioned, does not hold up well. The songs are not timeless. You have some good dancing numbers, and that's about it.
And I mean, the satire and the pointedness of the original is largely sanded down because you don't have the storyline of the count and the burglaries and the, you know, the upper crust and the proletariat. No, it's all stripped out for this guy who's making a movie.
And he's a theatrical agent in the play. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Even that is different.
Yeah. Well, the plot is also sort of weirdly dense and complicated. It's not hard to figure out, but I was watching some of the early scenes. Like I said, the scene where they're in the commissar's office in Russia, and then when they come back to Paris and we're arguing about what's going to be in the movie, and then we meet the go on the movie set. And there's all this plot stuff that seems kind of overcomplicated and unnecessary. And it just feels like if they had confidence in their musical numbers and they have hired all these people who can perform and be fun, that they probably would have just done more of it. Now, I say that with the proviso that one of my least, I enjoyed the Fred and Ginger movies of the 30s, but the plots are ridiculous. You just sort of go with it. This movie tries too hard to have too much plot. And I'm just like, less plot, please. Could we do that?
They're straight up farces.
Yeah.
And it's all mistaken identity, but they're all very light. They're fast. They're quick. This one has minimal complications and just drags its feet on all of them.
It's like 2 hours almost.
Leaden. And, you know, like Anything Goes, which we brought up before, which is probably still my favorite of all the Porters. I saw the 1987 Lincoln Center version, which is still one of the best musicals I've ever seen on stage. It was just clever. It was not designed to be played against a flat ship set, which everyone else does, including Sutton Foster. As much as I enjoyed this one,
they never made that into a movie after 1934. Like, it wasn't something that got remade.
Well, actually,
yes.
So they did do the version in the 30s with Bing Crosby, which somehow takes the little bit of racist subplot in the play and amps it up.
Yep.
I think that's why I've blocked it from my memory, even though I know it exists.
And then in 1956, it was remade with Bing Crosby again and Donald O'Connor. And it has a script by Sidney Sheldon.
Jeez, I'm not familiar with that one.
Pretty much the only things they have in common is that they've got Bing Crosby and they're on cruise ships. It has
Games
nothing
at sea,
to do
right?
with it. Basically,
is it any good? I'm looking it up.
No. Way. Oh, it's awful. Again, it has that same weird bloat that those late 50s musicals have. It's just awkward and leaden. They redid it for the stage in the 60s as a little bit more campy with Hal Linden. I have that album too. It was weird, you know, listening to that going, that's Barney Miller. No, that's not right.
He did a lot of musical stuff before he did Barney Miller.
And he was delightful in it. But the Lincoln Center version where they revised it is great. And that's basically the version, that's basically the same script they're using for the Sutton Foster one. But the very original script was written by P.G. Wodehouse and Guy Bolton, who had done all these early comedies with Jerome Kern in the 20s. And they did have to rewrite it because there was a real shipwreck right before the play opened. So they were like, maybe our play about a sinking ship and a bunch of people shipwrecked on an island won't go over well. So they totally revised it in the weeks before it opened. And that's the version we all know and love, if you know and love it. But yeah, it's odd that it's never been made into a really good movie. I'd have loved to see the 87 one turned into a film. And there's a Stanley Tucci, Oliver Platt movie called The Imposters, which looks it. I mean, it so could have been a template for an Anything Goes film. It's, you know, it's the only thing it has in common is that it's set in, I think, the 30s on a cruise ship. But it's beautiful to look at.
It just feels like it would be would have been ripe for a film in the,
yeah.
You know, it's a shame about the mid-50s one. I just looked at that, and Wodehouse and Bolton still have the credit and sit along with Sidney Sheldon. So I guess there was enough of that original to keep them on the masthead, so to speak.
I think it was just that they were names.
Fair point, yeah.
It's because it literally bears no relation to it.
Well, friends, I think perhaps we've said as much as we care to say about Silk Stocking.
I think so. Yeah, this has basically become the Cole Porter cast.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about chapter markers right now.
Yeah. My dream has come true. I'd like to propose a segment.
Yes. Well, no. There you go. It's the Porter segment. We'll work on that. Well, thank you, David J. Lohr and Philip Michaels, for joining me to talk about Silk Stockings, a movie which we all saw. You can go to theincomparable.com/LTS and you can subscribe to the show. You can follow us on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield because S's cost extra. Or you can follow me personally on Twitter at Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y. And that's enough to be getting on with. Bye now.